My ears blot the voices out. The memory comes in a dark, airless rush. Me, pitching to my knees on the shore, the water black and greedy in front of me, the cold whip of the wind across my cheeks, the sickening heave of too much whiskey mixed with God knows what else in the pit of my stomach. Kaylee's scream shrill in my ears, her hands grasping at my arms, dragging me back. Zoe's body in the water, sinking down, down. Anna? Paisley's looking up at me. I force myself to smile, tell her it's fine. We're fine. When the police arrive, we're all instructed to leave, go home, clear out. We make our way toward the park exit along with everyone else. Martina talking a mile a minute, Paisley clutching both our hands. We don't know what they'll find, I assure Paisley, my voice a pale impression of normal. That spotlight can't work very well on a bright day like this. It could be anything on the lake bottom, just a big rock. But it's not a rock. I know it, deep in the hollows of my gut. She's down there. Zoe's down there in that boat. My legs sway beneath me, and Martina clutches my arm to keep me from falling. I'm walking you home, she says. You look sick. I'm fine, I mumble, but I'm not. I can't keep the truth compartmentalized any longer. Zoe messaged me in December. She gave me her number, told me things about her life. On New Year's Eve, she disappeared. On New Year's Eve, I blacked out. I'll take Paisley in to Mrs. Bellamy and explain you're not feeling well. You need to get some sleep. I nod weakly. Paisley squeezes my hand and says she hopes I feel better soon. We keep walking until we get to Clovelly Cottage, and Martina sends me around back to the pool house while she and Paisley go up to the front. Somehow, I get inside. When I'm alone, I pull out my phone with trembling hands. You need to tell me the truth about New Year's, I say when Kaylee picks up. There's a long pause on the other end of the line. I'm starting to remember, I press. Something bad. I lean all my weight against the back of the pool house door. My legs are liquid beneath me. Anna, she says finally. We should talk about New Year's, but not on the phone. You need to tell me, I say again. We came out to Heron Mills, you and me. What happened to Zoe? Look. She sounds like a mother reasoning with a disobedient toddler. I looked up that Zoe Spanos girl. We didn't know her. Kaylee's voice is insistent. But Kaylee is lying. I can handle it, Kay. We were together, you and me. She died that night. On the other end of the line, Kaylee lets out a deep, jagged breath. She's protecting me, but I know. Contained in that sound are all the things she doesn't want to tell me. Come home, Anna, so we can really talk. I end the call without saying goodbye. The dark thoughts that have been haunting me all summer dance across the pool house walls in one violent vignette after the next. Paisley floating face down in the ocean, blonde hair framing her small head like a halo, ravens on the Windermere balcony rail, everything tilting, falling. Paisley's broken body slumped across the back seat of the car, dark water rushing in. A girl falling, body twisting in a long white party dress with a pale yellow sash, her face frozen in terror. My face, Zoe's, falling again. The balcony rail disintegrating beneath me, beneath us. Shapes in the dark water, nighttime seeping over the surf, bodies made faceless in the near dark. Kaylee's scream shrill in my ears, her hands grasping at my arms, dragging me back. Zoe's body in the water, sinking down, down. And then I know. This isn't my mind playing tricks on me. This is guilt. beating against my skull, forcing itself out. My brain trying to show me the truth about Zoe, about what I did. In Brooklyn, I was able to keep it at bay for a while, drown the truth in booze, pot, pills, but not here. Not anymore. I collapse on the bed, on top of the covers, and press my face into the cool white pillow, willing sleep to come.
Missing Zoe, Episode 7, Max Factor. In our second segment, we'll hear from another acquaintance of Max Adler's. Mr. Adler was brought in by the Heron Mills PD this past Sunday, September 27th, for questioning. This follows my own observation that Anna Ciccone's former employers, the Bellamys, spoke with Heron Mills detectives on Saturday the 26th. However, the Bellamy family could not be reached for confirmation or comment. Getting back to what we know for sure, Mr. Adler is not under arrest at this time, but police are calling him a new person of interest in the Zoe Spanos investigation. While charges against Anna Ciccone have not been dropped, Judge Castera is considering a pretrial motion filed by the defense to dismiss both the charges of second-degree manslaughter and concealment of a corpse brought against Ms. Ciccone. If that happens, this case could be reopened as a homicide investigation. To get the inside scoop on Max Adler, I spoke yesterday with Michelle Heath, a third-year student in the marine biology program at Brown University.
Sure, I know Max. He graduated last year, but he was a pretty big presence in the bio department when he was here.
Can you tell us what you mean by a pretty big presence?
Max has a big personality. He wasn't the top student in the ecology and evolutionary bio program, but he probably could have been if he scaled the partying back a couple notches. He's charming and easy on the eyes. I'd say most every straight female biology major knew who Max was.
Going back to last fall, the fall of his senior year, was Max dating anyone?
Not that I'm aware of. He was dating this girl, Maxine, when I was a first year, which I only remember because they were Max and Maxine. But they broke up a long time ago. I heard rumors about him hooking up with a couple girls that fall, but I don't really know. I think he was holding out for Zoe.
Can you clarify for our listeners that the Zoe in question is Zoe Spanos?
That's right. Max had it bad for Zoe. It was pretty obvious. I wasn't super close with her, but we had a lab together that fall. This one time, toward the end of the semester, she was getting all these texts during lab. We were partnered up, and she kept stopping to check her phone. It was annoying. She apologized, saying Max wouldn't stop texting her.
And you're certain the texts were from Max Adler?
Completely. She showed me her screen. There was a whole string of texts asking her to meet up with him that night.
Do you remember when this was specifically?
Early December, I think. It was right before winter break.
Do you know if Zoe did meet up with Max? Does she tell you anything else about the nature of their relationship?
No, sorry. Like I said, we were just bio friends. I knew she had a boyfriend from home. Probably Max was trying to get Zoe to break up with him, but I'm just guessing.
Listeners, while the exact nature of Max Adler's relationship with Zoe Spanos remains unclear, what we know for sure is this. They knew each other from Brown and were close enough that they had exchanged phone numbers. We know also that the Heron Mills PD found reason to bring Mr. Adler in for questioning this weekend. I hope to bring you further updates on this development next week. I had planned to conclude this episode with a follow-up conversation with Anna Ciccone, but her legal team is not permitting further interviews while her pretrial motion is pending. I did speak with Anna off the record on Saturday, and she expressed her enthusiasm that Missing Zoe has gained so many listeners since we spoke earlier this month. In fact, episode 6 reached a record 60,000 downloads, which is all thanks to you. Please keep listening. I'm Martina Green, and I'll be back next week with more Missing Zoe.
Chapter 29. Then, August. Heron Mills, New York. When I wake up, it's dark. A full moon glows outside the window. I'm not sure how long I've been sleeping. On the nightstand are two cold pieces of toast and a glass of orange juice. It looks like I drank half of it, but I don't remember that. I don't remember Amelia coming to check on me either, but she must have. Next to the plate is a note. Sleep as long as you need to. Please call if you need anything. Amelia. I force myself to sit up and take a couple wooden bites of toast. I feel hungry, but my stomach clenches, and I push the plate aside, afraid I won't be able to keep it down. I search my pockets for my phone, then my bag. My legs feel like rubber bands. My mouth tastes like chalk. Finally, I find it plugged into the charger in the pool house kitchen. Amelia must have done that too. I lean heavily against the counter and navigate to the news, dreading what I know I'll find, but needing to see it anyway. George Spanos of Heron Mills, New York, was seen entering the town morgue at 3:47 p.m. on Monday. Local officials confirm he was called in to identify the body of a young woman found in Parrish Lake. Earlier this morning, Parks Director Paula Ames alerted police to the presence of a small motorboat submerged toward the center of the lake, which was discovered by her staff during algae cleanup efforts. When it was raised to the surface, a young woman's body was found in the bed of the motorboat, enclosed beneath a tarp. While officials have not yet confirmed the identity of the body, the disappearance of 19-year-old Zoe Spanos from Heron Mills last December 31st is at the forefront of local residents' minds. A small motorboat belonging to Catherine Hunt, also of Heron Mills, was reported missing that same night, and police have long suspected the two events may be connected. I stumble into the bathroom and lose my two bites of toast into the toilet bowl. When I crawl back into bed, I am afraid to close my eyes. The bees are back, swirling around the inside of my skull until all I can hear is a dull, ringing wail. 3 days after she messaged me, Zoe disappeared, and now a boat, a body. In my mind, I'm on the balcony at Windermere again. It's winter. Fat flakes swirl all around, and on the railing a white ribbon of snow is starting to gather. The night is cold and crisp. The house lights are out, but up above, a round moon glows through the treetops, and the sky is dotted with stars. Zoe's there, in a gold dress with a billowy taffeta skirt. Her hair is twisted up in a high knot. She looks like a ballerina. Kaylee's there too, huddled into her puffy winter coat and clutching a highball glass. She raises her glass toward me in a toast, and it sparkles golden in the moonlight. Then she drains it in one gulp before slipping through the door into Windermere. I look down at myself. I'm wearing my ugly brown winter boots and the navy pea coat I've had since 10th grade. Beneath my coat is a party dress. "Aren't you cold?" I ask Zoe. Kaylee and I are all bundled up, but she's only wearing a summery dress. Zoe laughs, the sound a shower of stardust in the night. "Dance with me, Anna." She twirls once, twice, her slippers making delicate circles in the snow. Then she reaches out, and I take her hands in mine, one arm crossed over the other in a long X. She's laughing, and then I'm laughing, and we're both twirling, ballerinas in the crisp winter night. We spin and spin, and then I feel my feet slipping on the snow. "Anna!" she screams, and her hands slip out of mine, two birds bursting into flight, and then Zoe, too, is flying, the backs of her knees glancing off the balcony rail, her gold dress soaring into the moonlit night, and I'm falling back, back, onto the balcony, my back striking the ground, then my head and everything fading into blackness. I squeeze my eyes shut, press my fists into the lids until I see stars. It would be so easy to dismiss everything I just saw as the work of my overactive imagination. But I can't. The sun is streaming bright and hot through the pool house windows. It's late. My phone is buzzing on the kitchen counter, a text message reminder. Something tells me it's been buzzing for a while. I drag myself out of bed and into the bathroom, where I stick my head under the faucet and gulp mouthfuls of cold water. I can't get enough. I drink and drink until my stomach hurts. My phone buzzes again, drawing me into the kitchen. The texts are from Caden. You probably know already. Zoe's dad identified her body. I'm leaving the police station now. This text is a courtesy, Anna. The police are going to be coming to Clovelly Cottage this afternoon. I don't understand it, but I know you know something. You need to talk to the police. I close out of the texts and look at the time, 1:20 p.m. I've been sleeping for over 24 hours. I can't believe Amelia let me sleep so long. My chest tightens with a fresh rush of guilt. In the bedroom, I grab my sketchbook and watercolor pencils from the table. Then I flip through to a clean page and begin to draw, letting my memory guide me. My hand flies across the paper in confident, bold strokes. It's a sketch of the famous waterhouse painting of the Lady of Shalott, a painting I've copied dozens of times before. I don't even need to look at the original. I can copy it from memory. But instead of Waterhouse's red-haired lady, the woman in the boat is Zoe. My watercolors capture her raven hair, olive skin, the boat, her watery grave. I breathe. For the first time in days, everything is perfectly, brilliantly clear. I've been moving through a dense gray fog, and suddenly the sun is out. I understand it now, what my brain's been trying to tell me. Caden's already notified the police. No sense in waiting for them to come here, to the Bellamy's front door. I still feel nauseous and a little unsteady, but the bees are gone. I set my pencil down and tuck the sketchbook away. With a grim, fixed determination, I turn on the shower and pull a red tank top and a clean pair of cutoffs out of my drawer. I'm going to get ready, and then I'm going down to the station myself.
Missing Zoe, Episode 8, Through a Telescope Lens.
A couple days after Christmas, she starts texting me. Wants to know if I want to hang out over break. Then sometime mid-afternoon on New Year's, she asks if I want to come out to Heron Mills for a party at this guy Jacob Trainer's house.
Thanks for tuning in to the 8th episode of Missing Zoe. Today is Tuesday, October 6th, and it's been 2 months and 2 days since Zoe's body was found in Parrish Lake. Her death remains unsolved, and we're still missing Zoe. I'm going to cut right to the chase today. As you know, if you've been following the action in the past week, Max Adler of Montauk, New York, was brought in for questioning in the Zoe Spanos case, identified as a person of interest by the Heron Mills PD, and then released without charge. I caught up with Mr. Adler over the weekend at his family's home in Montauk, and I'm pleased to bring the interview to you today.
There's a lot of misinformation out there, and I've seen a bunch about myself this week. To be perfectly honest, I don't trust the mainstream media, but people are listening to your podcast, and I want to clear some things up.
Thanks for agreeing to speak with me, Max. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what happened with police this past weekend?
Right. I got called into the station on Sunday morning. I agreed to go voluntarily. I was never arrested. Detectives Holloway and Massey said they had some questions about the night Zoe Spanos disappeared following a conversation they'd had with the kid Anna had been babysitting this summer.
Did they tell you the content of that conversation?
They did. Seems she saw me through her bedroom window on New Year's Eve. I guess the girl has a telescope in her room. The Bellamys live next door to the Talbots. Caden Talbot is the guy Zoe had been dating, as everyone knows. Apparently, fireworks woke the kid up after she'd gone to bed that night. She went to the window to look and saw Zoe and me entering the stable, then me leaving alone.
And is that true? Were you and Zoe at the Talbot estate on New Year's Eve?
Yeah, we were there for about an hour that night.
Can you tell us what you told police?
Here's the deal. Zoe and I knew each other from bio at Brown. I was 2 years ahead of her, and I had a girlfriend when she was a first year. But then last year, I was single, and Zoe and I kept running into each other around the department. I finally convinced her to go out for a coffee with me, and she told me she was having a rough time at home. Stuff with her dad, although she didn't say what. Things weren't great with her boyfriend either. He'd been distant since the summer. She thought they were drifting apart. Naturally, I figured she was opening up to me about this for a reason. I thought she was interested. I asked her out a few times, and she kept saying, not right now. But it wasn't a hard no. I didn't push, but I figured she was waiting to see how things played out with her boyfriend. I respected that. Then, after Thanksgiving, she came back to campus and called me, super upset. She asked me to meet her in the library, so I went. Said while she was home over Thanksgiving, she'd found these pictures and emails on Caden's computer. He was in love with another girl.
Zoe knew about Tiana Percy?
Tiana, right. She was in the news recently, provided Caden's alibi for New Year's Eve. Anyway, Zoe came to me about this, right? I figure she wants revenge at the very least, or even better, she's ready to move on.
And then what happened?
Nothing. She tells me she shouldn't have said anything and she has to leave. She barely talks to me again until it's almost winter break. And then the weekend before break starts, I hear she's at Yale visiting Caden. So I figure they worked things out, whatever.
Did you see her again before the semester ended?
Just once in the lab. But then a couple days after Christmas, she starts texting me. Wants to know if I want to hang out over break. I say sure, but she drags her feet on making a plan. Then sometime mid-afternoon on New Year's, she asks if I want to come out to Heron Mills for a party at this guy Jacob Trainer's house. Turns out Jacob and I have a couple friends in common from baseball back in high school, so I say sure, I'll go. I had plans in Montauk, but I ditched them for her.
Did Zoe ask you to meet her at the party?
No, she wanted to pre-party before we went over. Told me to meet her at Windermere and gave me the address. I thought it was her house. I didn't know it was Caden's. She met me at the front gate and took me around back to the stable. The Bellamy girl must have watched us walking inside.
And when was this?
Early. 9:30, maybe.
Okay. What happened once you got to the stable?
Like I said, Zoe wanted to pre-party before we went out. I'd brought a six-pack, but she had an open bottle of whiskey in the stable, and judging from how she was acting when I got there, she was already a couple shots in when I arrived.
And how was Zoe acting?
She was all over me, kissing me, running her hands all over my chest. It was cool at first. We made out for a while. I offered her a beer, but she said she was going to stick with whiskey. Judging by how emotional she got, I don't think she was much of a drinker.
Do you know how much she drank that night?
The bottle was almost empty when I got there, but I don't know how much she'd already had. I stayed long enough to drink a beer and part of a second before she really started flipping out. She kept running her fingers along her neck. She wasn't wearing that necklace she always has on, the little gold chain with her initials on it, and it was like she kept reaching for it, but it wasn't there. Things got real weird when she started crying and kind of writhing around on the stable floor, moaning about Caden and Tiana. That shit killed the mood real fast.
Did she say anything specific that you remember?
She wasn't making a whole lot of sense, but she said something about being in Caden's stable, drinking his whiskey, and then I put two and two together. She had a flash drive in her fist she kept waving around, and eventually she threw it against one of the stall doors. She was a mess.
And what did you do?
I tried to get her to stop crying, said I'd drive her home, but she told me to leave. I didn't want to leave her like that, but she was screaming, "Get the hell out and leave me alone." Finally, I just left her there.
You left Zoe in the stable?
I know it sounds like a dick move, but believe me, she wanted me gone. I think she wanted to hook up with someone under Caden's roof. A kind of fuck you, you know? And then she changed her mind. So I left.
And that's when you were seen again, from the Bellamy's house.
Must have been. It was probably around 10:30, and yeah, there were fireworks going off nearby and a bunch of people partying on the beach. It was loud, normal stuff for New Year's. I left the stable and walked around the side of the house, back to the front where I'd left my car. Zoe must have walked. There weren't any other cars parked on the street out front. Then I drove to Trainer's place. I figured since I'd come all the way out to Heron Mills, I might as well hit up the party. And thank God I did, because lots of people saw me that night. The police had already looked through a bunch of photos. I was in a few, and I had a bunch of alibi witnesses.
Did you hear from Zoe at all after you left Windermere?
Nope. Honestly, I wasn't that worried. I just figured she'd walked home and was sleeping it off. It wasn't until a couple days later that I heard on the news she was missing.
And why didn't you go to the police then? You could have helped put a few pieces together months ago.
I know, okay? It wasn't my finest hour. But honestly, I knew her disappearance didn't have anything to do with me. She was drunk and upset when I left the stable, sure, but she was fine. I was trying to graduate from Brown. I didn't want to get tangled up in a missing persons investigation. I don't know what happened that night any more than anyone else.
And you didn't try to get in touch with her at all?
Look, I know this doesn't make me sound great, but no, I didn't. She was a hot mess. It was kind of a turnoff. Maybe I should have checked in with her, sure, but I didn't have anything to do with Zoe winding up at the bottom of Parrish Lake. Walking away when a girl tells you to leave her alone isn't a crime. The police agreed.
The day after Zoe's body was found, Caden Talbot told police that he'd discovered an empty bottle of whiskey and two empty beer bottles in the stable on January 1st. Presumably those belonged to you and Zoe.
The whiskey was technically Caden's, from what Zoe was saying, but yeah, the two beer bottles would have been mine.
And it was just you and Zoe pre-partying in the stable. Anna Ciccone wasn't with you?
No way. I met Anna for the first time this summer when she came to the aquarium where I work. She definitely wasn't drinking with us that night.
And what about Kaylee Harrison?
Kaylee?
Anna's friend, from Brooklyn, who she said in her August 5th confession was with her at Windermere the night Zoe disappeared?
Oh, right. I've met Kaylee. Anna brought her to a party over the summer. But no, she wasn't there that night. I only met Kaylee once, this July. Unless Zoe invited someone else over after I left, it was definitely just Zoe and me drinking in the stable. Those were our bottles Caden found.
Thanks, Max. Okay, listeners, it's go time. Missing Zoe reached 80,000 of you last episode. That's huge. That means there are a lot of you tuning in. People who want justice for Zoe, who know that justice doesn't happen without the whole truth. And now it's my turn to ask you a favor. If you have any information about the night of December 31st or morning of January 1st that might help police uncover what happened to Zoe Spanos after Max Adler left her alone in the Windermere stable, this is the time to come forward, even if it's a detail that seems insignificant. With the information we know now, the likelihood that Anna Ciccone was even in Heron Mills the night Zoe died is very, very slim. Anna's pretrial motion to dismiss the charges against her is still pending review by the court. If anyone has information that could help prevent the wrongful conviction and imprisonment of an innocent girl, this is the time to step up. Anna needs you. It's your responsibility to help. You can reach an anonymous tip line established by the Spanos family at 631-958-2757. Or you can contact the Heron Mills PD directly. Next up, I'll be speaking to criminal defense attorney Katarina Wall. Ms. Wall does not represent Anna Ciccone, but she'll be able to provide a general overview of the legal procedures involved in pretrial motions to dismiss in New York State.
Chapter 30. October. Heron Mills, New York. It's late. The night sky swirls with the first inky ribbons of autumn crisped air as Martina and Aster make their way through the girl-sized gaps in the unkempt privacy hedge that has long ceased to effectively partition Windermere from Linden Lane. A wayward branch reaches out to snare Martina's hair in its grasp, and she pauses a second to free her ponytail, yank it back into place. Martina's mind travels to the olive branch she extended to Aster tonight when she invited her to come along. Things have been frosty, verging on Arctic between the two girls since Martina aired her interview with Anna 3 weeks ago. There was a momentary thaw when it looked like Max Adler might be a real suspect. A new arrest to give the Spanos family hope while Anna's story disintegrated between their fingers. But with no arrest made and Max's role crystallizing in the public eye, an asshole for sure, but not a killer. The glares Aster shoots Martina at school have become pure ice again. Aster walks 10 steps ahead of Martina, her pace quick and sure-footed. Martina has barely extracted herself from the privacy hedge, but Aster is halfway down the drive, veering right to skirt the porch, her body swallowed by shadow as she rounds the side of the estate. Martina picks up her pace. Her friend knows the Windermere grounds well, has spent afternoons here with Zoe and Caden, others babysitting Paisley. But this place, made even more gothic, more ghostly in the cold October moonlight, is uncharted ground for Martina. She stops a moment to tip her head back, straight up to the third floor balcony that has loomed with infamy in her mind's eye since August. It juts out against the sky, a stone jaw missing a few teeth at the rails. No bird-boned girl could survive a fall from such a height. But no, Martina reminds herself, pressing on down the drive after Aster. No one fell from Windermere. To sort story from reality, fact from fabrication. That's why Martina is here tonight, at least she hopes. She's here for Anna, mostly. She spent weeks torn between Anna's potential guilt and innocence. But now Martina is sure. Anna didn't kill Zoe, accidentally or otherwise, but someone did. She hurries quietly around the side of the estate, into the backyard where the weeds reach up to snag her tights like bony fingers in the moonlight. She shivers. Aster is already at the back of the property, feet planted in the soot where the stable doors used to be. Their destination, the ruined ground, the keeper of Zoe's secrets. Because after Max left Zoe alone that night, something happened. Her story continued, then ended somewhere between the Windermere stable and Parrish Lake. The rational part of Martina's brain says it's too late to find anything here, that the police missed their chance at answers when Caden threw away the empties he found, when Max failed to report his story back when it could have been of any use, before the stable burned to the ground 3 months ago. But a small, insistent tug in her gut says she has to look for herself, for Anna, and that bringing Aster with her tonight, including her in this longest of long-shot attempts at finding something, anything police missed in the ruins of the Windermere stable, might be the only chance she has of winning her friend's forgiveness. Because if they find something tonight, a scrap of information, a shred of a clue, maybe, just maybe, Aster will begin to thaw the hard wall of ice she's raised between them. Martina steals one glance back at the Windermere, eyes traveling up to the second floor. The windows are dark. Caden is all the way across the Long Island Sound in New Haven, but Mrs. Talbot is inside, hopefully sleeping deeply. Martina feels bad about snooping around out here without permission, but she knows enough about Caden's mom's desire for privacy to know that asking would have gotten her nowhere. So, see anything? She stage whispers to Aster as she steps across a charred beam into the soot. Aster stays where she is. She hooks her thumbs into her jeans pockets and shrugs. What's to see? She asks, not even attempting to whisper. Martina flinches, but they're far enough out on the property that there's no way Mrs. Talbot could hear them through closed windows. Hopefully. It's just a bunch of burned up wood and charred metal, Aster continues. If there was ever anything to find, it burned with the stable. Martina presses her lips between her teeth. Aster's not wrong, probably. But she had been hoping that once they got here, Aster would get into the spirit of the search. Instead, her resentment toward Martina is as steely as ever. I'm going to start looking around. Martina tugs on a pair of latex gloves and holds another out toward Aster, who takes them soundlessly. Then she slips her phone from her jacket pocket and switches on the flashlight app, holding the beam close to the ground and hoping it won't attract any unwanted attention. Wood crumbles beneath her boots as she walks toward what used to be the far end of the stable, in the general direction of Caden's stall. At the front of the stable, Aster sinks down onto a plank of what probably used to be rafter and scuffs the ground aimlessly with her foot. Phone in one hand, Martina begins sifting through the rubble. She's not even sure what she's looking for, if she's entirely honest, which she'd rather not be. She needs to find something. Something that will lead to justice for Zoe, that will win her best friend back, that will compel the judge to grant Anna's pretrial motion to dismiss. It's a lot to hope for. A wheedling voice at the back of her head says the Heron Mills PD won't thank her for meddling with what might be a crime scene. But they've shown little interest in the Windermere grounds after Max Adler spoke with them. She knows they've been out here once, about a week ago, but the visit seems to have been perfunctory. Nothing's taped off, no evidence tagged, no sign that the police plan to return. Their thinking seems to be very much in line with Aster's. Whatever evidence there was to be found here was witlessly tossed by Caden in January or sent up in flames in July. Martina knows it's a real possibility that Zoe left the stable shortly after Max that night, that whatever happened to her happened far from Windermere. But she's not ready to give up yet. She's been on her hands and knees for less than a minute, tights and gloves thoroughly blackened with ash, when the flashlight beam catches a small glint in the rubble. The fine hairs on the back of her neck prickle. She switches her phone off and slips it back into her dress pocket. Breath hitched in the back of her throat, she glances over her shoulder. Behind her, Aster is still scuffing the toe of her shoe in the dirt, boredom glazed across her face. Martina's pulse quickens. She won't say anything until she's sure. She scoots closer. As her fingers find the gleam in the ash, cool and delicate and familiar, a voice cuts across the lawn. You! Just the one word. Both girls' heads whip around toward the source of the sound. 10 yards away, but approaching fast, Mrs. Talbot is striding across the grounds in a blood-red nightgown and black riding boots. The girls' faces are snared instantly in a flood of white light from the hurricane lamp clutched in the older woman's right hand. In her left swings something else, the length of a hunting rifle. Martina stops breathing. Let's get out of here, Aster mutters, shoving herself to her feet. But before she can run, Martina is next to her, clutching her wrist and her soot-smeared glove. Wait, she cautions, frozen by visions of Mrs. Talbot raising the rifle, firing after them as they run across the lawn toward Clovelly Cottage. Is that a gun? But it's a parasol with a long, ornate wooden handle, lovely, if rather out of place in the moonlight. Every few steps, Mrs. Talbot presses its pointy tip into the grass like a cane. You, she says again, and Aster wrenches herself from Martina's grasp. I've seen you here before. She raises the makeshift cane, points it straight at Martina. Pretty or not, she doesn't doubt it could do some damage. I haven't, Martina starts to say. But before she can finish, the stick wavers. Toward Aster. On my property, Mrs. Talbot continues. Trespassing, just like tonight. She stops at the threshold to the stable, as if doors still stood between them. The pointy end of the parasol trembles in the air, a foot from Aster's chest. Martina sucks in a sharp breath. in her jacket pocket, her fingers close around her phone. I used to bring Paisley over here, Aster says, voice shaky. Remember? I know who you are, Mrs. Talbot says, voice slicing the night air. Little Aster Spanos, always tagging after Zoe. Your sister's the only reason I didn't call the cops the other times I saw you back here, snooping around. Your family's already had so much grief. Her voice softens then, and the parasol lowers slowly to the ground. We're very sorry, Martina says. We were just leaving. With her free hand, she reaches slowly toward Aster's elbow, ready to guide her friend away from the stable. Aster flinches back. That wasn't me, she says, voice pitched high. You've got it wrong. Careful there, the older woman growls. Don't tell me what I saw. The parasol's pointy tip jabs the air. This time, Martina flinches. Mrs. Talbot has likely endured a lifetime of people telling her what she saw or didn't see, what's reality and what's an invention of her brain. Maybe Aster didn't intend to make any hasty implications, but she needs to let this go. The parasol jerks then, toward Martina. She lets out a small gasp, raising both hands in front of her. And you, Mrs. Talbot says, eyes narrowing. You're the Jenkins girl. Martina, she manages to get out. I'm well aware. Mrs. Talbot presses her lips together in disapproval. You've done my son no favors with your podcast. Back to stir up more trouble. Martina swallows, but her throat stays dry. We're very sorry. Again, it's just, after what Max Adler told police, and they don't seem to be looking very hard, so we thought we'd try on our own. And what did you find? Mrs. Talbot shines the bright LED light of the hurricane lamp on Martina's raised hands. Her fingers are still wrapped around her phone. And something else. A gleam of gold in the lamplight. Martina tries to shove it back into her jacket pocket, but Mrs. Talbot's words stop her short. I saw you back there, pulling it from the rubble. Is that Zoe's? Martina's eyes flicker to her friend. No. It's Aster's. In the back of her mind, the implications have been spiraling since the second her fingers closed around the gold hoop earring with the helixed twist. The last time she saw Aster wearing them was the afternoon before Martina's interview with Anna aired. Martina assumed her friend had taken the earrings off to spite her, but the flash in Aster's eyes now tells Martina she was wrong. Dead wrong. You don't know that, Aster says, voice high and sharp. They're hardly one of a kind. But Martina does know. Fear dances across Aster's face. Mrs. Talbot saw you, she says, not quite gently. On the grounds, more than once. What have you been doing at Windermere? Aster's eyes dart between Martina and Mrs. Talbot. She takes a step back. For a moment, it looks like she's going to run, and Martina reaches out toward her friend. Aster flinches away from Martina's grasp. I didn't, she starts to say, then falters. I'm sure the authorities will sort this out, Mrs. Talbot says. If you weren't doing anything wrong, Aster, there's no need to worry. Her voice is brittle. Aster freezes. Two sets of eyes are trained on her, burning through her skin. To Martina, she looks like a rabbit snared in high beams. Pure panic blooms across her face. For a second that seems to yawn out forever, no one speaks. No one moves. Then, lightning quick, Aster's hand shoots down into the rubble. When she straightens up, she's clutching a charred metal beam, about the length and width of her forearm. Martina stumbles back. What are you doing? Your fucking podcast, Aster spits, taking a step forward. Martina's eyes flicker to Mrs. Talbot, silently willing the older woman to do something, but Mrs. Talbot is stepping back, back, back toward the house, away from this turn of events. I'm sorry, Martina mutters, although she's not sorry. Not at all, just confused. Her mind whirs. Astor came here, to the ruins of the Windermere stable, the day the interview with Anna aired. She lost her earring. And that's not the only time Mrs. Talbot has seen her on the grounds. Now Astor is threatening her. She's missing dots, or lines to connect them. Can't think at all, with Astor stepping toward her again, beam trembling in her hand.
You ruined everything, Martina. Can't you see that?
Martina can't see anything beyond the twisted piece of metal in Astor's hand. She swallows.
I ruined everything,
she repeats. Her heart is pounding. She can't outrun Astor, star athlete versus wannabe journalist. All she has are her words, and they're failing her.
I should never have done the podcast, gotten involved. You were getting way too close,
Astor continues.
Back in July, someone took the flash drive and Caden's stupid apology card. It was you.
It was Anna, Martina thinks. But this is hardly the time for technicalities.
You set the fire,
she says numbly.
You can't prove that, Astor snaps, panic rising in her voice. You need to back off. Forget what you think you found.
I'm sorry, Martina says again. The words taste sour on her tongue. Astor may not be ready to admit it, but it's all coming into focus. Astor had been keeping tabs on the flash drive and Caden's card. When they disappeared, she set the stable on fire. What's still murky is why.
When she confessed, I could breathe again, Astor says. But then you couldn't let it go. The police believed her. Everyone believed her except you, Martina.
Astor's words sing with venom and fear. Blood rushes to Martina's head, roars in her ears. Behind her, Martina can hear Mrs. Talbot's voice, but she can't make out what the older woman is saying. She must be back at the house by now, abandoning Martina, saving herself. She could have left her the parasol at least. Not that Martina's sure she could have used it, even to protect herself. Astor takes another step forward, and Martina steps back. Her foot lands on a broken beam, and her ankle rolls. First, Mrs. Talbot, now her own body, betraying her. She goes down hard, wood splinters biting into her palms and tailbone cracking painfully against the dirt. The earring and her phone skid away from her into the ash. A whimper slips through her lips, and Astor takes a step forward, two, until she's standing directly over Martina, one foot on each side of her chest.
Let it go, Martina.
It's part warning, part plea.
Promise me.
Martina's eyes fill with tears. Her best friend, petite Astor, too short for swimming and 10 times as fierce because of it, is standing over her, metal beam clutched in her hand. It's shaking, hard.
Okay,
Martina says.
Okay.
Astor looks down at the rod, really seeing it for the first time.
Shit,
she mutters. She flings it hard into the grass, like it might bite. Then she collapses down beside Martina, buries her face in her hands.
I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I'd never...
Martina shoves herself up to a sitting position, then places her palm hesitantly on her best friend's shoulder.
Astor,
she whispers. It'll be okay. We're going to figure this out.
Astor Spanos,
a woman's voice cuts across the lawn. Both girls' heads snap up. The woman is striding purposefully toward them.
My name is Officer Gwendolyn Park with the Heron Mills PD. Trespassing,
she can hear Mrs. Talbot say from somewhere safely across the lawn. And now this. Martina thinks she can make out a second uniformed figure standing next to her. The older woman's words from earlier flood her ears. Your sister's the only reason I didn't call the cops the other times I saw you back here, snooping around. But this time, she'd made that call. Probably before she even came outside.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Talbot.
Very slowly, Astra struggles to her feet. She offers her hand to Martina, who takes it, allows herself to be helped up. She searches her friend's eyes, desperate for the truth. But Astra looks away.
We have a few questions we need you girls to answer, Officer Park is saying.
She approaches, shines her flashlight beam at their feet until it lands on Astra's earring. In a minute, her partner is at her side. Carefully, eyes never leaving Astra, he slips on a pair of gloves, then bends down to pluck the earring from the ash. He places it in a baggie, then turns to Martina.
Is everything okay here?
For a moment, Martina's eyes stray to the metal rod, where it landed in the grass. Then she turns back to the officer.
I'm fine.
Out of the corner of her eye, Martina can see Astra exhale. He nods.
We need you to come down to the station with us. Both of you.
Martina hears the words voluntary interview and your parents and your cooperation. And then she stops listening as the officers guide them toward the front of Windermere, toward the car. She tries to catch Aster's eyes one more time, but Aster won't meet her gaze.
Chapter 31, October. Pathways, Juvenile Center, East New York, Brooklyn. I'm awake now. That's not quite right. I've been awake something like 16 hours a day, usually more, since I came to Pathways over 2 months ago. Minimum 1,040 hours of awakeness. But now, these past few days, it's like I'm emerging from a very long, deeply muddled dream. It's that feeling the morning after you've taken something to help you sleep. The drug's still there in your bloodstream, fuzzing the edges, padding the air between you and the bright light of morning. But you're awake, clawing your way to the surface. Here's what I know to be true. Something happened on New Year's Eve. Something very bad. But I was not in Heron Mills. And I did not kill Zoe Spanos. Almost 2 weeks after my defense team filed the pretrial motion, 5 days after the prosecution filed their response, and while we're all waiting for the judge to set a date to hear our case, I'm informed that Pathways has finally granted the update to my approved visitors list that I requested back in August. My lawyers advise against the meeting, prep me on the things I absolutely cannot say. Aubrey, my fidgety social worker, says I should do what will best benefit my mental and emotional health and well-being. Thanks, Aubrey. Pretty sure both of those things haven't been very well for a few months now. But this is a conversation I need to have. I've been trying to reach Zoe's dad for weeks, at his business address so Astra and Mrs. Spanos wouldn't see my letters. On Friday afternoon, the guard, who always smells like sandalwood, tells me that George Spanos is waiting for me. Now that my innocence has settled in my gut like a solid fact, not a shifting, bruising question, I need to see him more than ever. I let her escort me upstairs. We're in the lounge, a cold room trying to be warm with stained orange and yellow couches and a few windows that could use a good scrub. A smattering of other inmates with their visitors perch on couch cushions and prop elbows against tabletops. Two guards lean like land-bound hawks against the wall near the door. Across a little white table, Zoe's dad stares down into his oily coffee. I've been trying to see him for weeks, but now that he's here, my stomach is doing flip-flops. I pick at the paint flaking up from the tabletop. I tried to come sooner, he says finally. I got your letters, but I wasn't on your list. I know. I meet his eyes for a second, then look away. I can't unsee the hungry animal grief that welled there the one time we met, that night at his glassed-in pool. He wants to know why I confessed. I want to know why he didn't tell me the truth. Before I can utter the words, police coercion or false memories or compromised reasoning ability or improper police procedure, he says, I knew it would only be a matter of time before you figured it out. And you deserve to know the truth. I stop picking at the paint. At first, I thought you were jealous. Zoe's life. She had everything. When Aster brought you to our home in July, my heart stopped. This girl, so much like my daughter. Nanny for the family next door to her fiancé. Befriending Caden. Befriending my younger daughter. Stepping into Zoe's life. It wasn't, I start to say, but he holds up his hand. Was it like that? Maybe that's exactly what I was doing. When you confessed 10 days later, I thought, of course you had found each other. Of course you would grow to resent her. My heart speeds up in my chest. I force myself to meet his eyes. His pupils are wide black pools. I don't think, I say finally, then start again. We never met, Zoe and me. Not like I thought we did. But she did reach out to me in December, right before she died. She found me online, said she needed to talk to me in person. She told me to come meet her in Heron Mills. That's why I thought. But I didn't. I didn't respond to her messages. I didn't go to the Hamptons last winter. Across the table, Mr. Spanos nods. Just once. A clipped, careful gesture. His coffee is getting cold. You know why she wanted to talk to me. Why she wanted to meet. He sighs, a long stream of breath that seems to deflate his entire body like a punctured tire. I think we both know the truth, Anna. I knew the minute I laid eyes on you this summer. Zoe was a smart girl. I knew she suspected, but I refused to talk to her about it. I wasn't ready to admit the truth. We look so much alike because we were sisters, I say slowly, watching his face, testing the words I think he wants me to say out loud. I'm your daughter. Mr. Spanos nods. The skin around his eyes relaxes. I met your mother years ago, when I was separated from my wife. She used to come to Heron Mills on vacation with her husband. John never knew, I don't think. Or maybe he did. Maybe that's why he left your mother. The thing is, Anna, I didn't know for certain until I saw you in July. Your mother never told me. When you were little, I had my suspicions. But Gloria swore you weren't mine. I hadn't seen you since you were 3 years old, and then the resemblance was only starting to show. But when you stepped into my house, when you told me your name.
Why now? I asked the man in front of me. My father. Why didn't you say something sooner? You could have saved me. Cleared up this mess.
He frowns.
I wouldn't go that far. I thought you were guilty, just like everyone else. And telling my wife, telling Aster, it would have torn my family apart for no reason. Not when we thought you would go to trial for Zoe's murder.
Second-degree manslaughter. I want to correct him, but I don't.
And now? I ask instead.
Now things have changed.
Because you believe me? That I didn't have anything to do with Zoe's death?
I know you didn't, he says, and tears fill his eyes.
beyond a shadow of a doubt.
How? I almost shout, and the guards snap to attention at the edges of the room. We're going to court soon, to argue the motion. If you know something that could help my case, you have to tell me. Mr. Spanos, please.
But he's already standing, chair scraping back against the cold concrete. The next word hitches on my tongue. Then I spit it out. Dad. He flinches.
I'm sorry, Anna. I've already said too much.
He's not going to tell me. He's going to leave me here.
For New York, Crime and Courts. Manslaughter charges dropped against Brooklyn teen as Long Island youth confesses to role in covering up sister's accidental death last New Year's Eve. Published October 11th at 12:56 p.m. A Brooklyn teen, awaiting trial in juvenile detention since her August confession to involvement in the death of Long Island resident Zoe Spanos, 19, was released on Saturday. Anna Ciccone, 17, was charged in August with second-degree manslaughter and concealment of a corpse. Ciccone's release came on the heels of the arrest and confession of Aster Spanos, also 17, younger sister of Zoe, whose body was found submerged in a boat in Heron Mills' Parish Lake last August. On Saturday, Judge Emanuela Castera announced that following Aster Spanos' arrest, Anna Ciccone would be released from Pathways Juvenile Center into the immediate care of her mother, Gloria Ciccone of Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Judge Castera had been previously considering a pretrial motion filed by Ciccone's defense team to dismiss the charges against her on the grounds of police misconduct. The motion was expedited and granted on Saturday. While full details of Aster Spanos' confession have not been released, Spanos' lawyer said in a statement this morning that, quote, Miss Spanos has come forward, truthfully and willingly, to disclose information she knew regarding the tragic and entirely accidental death of her sister Zoe last New Year's Eve. Miss Spanos did not cause her sister's death, nor has she been charged as such. She is cooperating fully with police. The Spanos family requests the public's respect for their privacy at this deeply difficult time. End quote. According to police, Aster Spanos was initially taken in for questioning late Thursday evening after a neighbor complained about Spanos and another teen trespassing on her property. In a follow-up interview on Friday, she disclosed information to police regarding her sister's January 1st death and admitted to finding and concealing her body. The rationale for Spanos' actions is not yet known. Aster Spanos has been charged with concealment of a corpse, a.k.a. Amanda Lynn's Law, a Class E felony in New York State. The crime carries up to 4 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. As a minor without a previous criminal record, it is unlikely that Spanos will serve the maximum sentence if convicted.
Chapter 32. October. Heron Mills Village Police Department, Long Island, New York. Detective Mira Holloway's shift ended an hour ago, but she's still in the interview room, reviewing the tape. It's been over 24 hours since Aster Spanos' arrest. This is the third time the detective has watched the interview from start to finish, pen in hand. They were overeager with the Ciccone girl, everything they thought they knew dissolving to mud. But now they've been offered a second chance like manna from heaven. She should really go home,